Good evening, friends. Oh, welcome to the Zen Center tonight. Is anyone here for the very first time to the Zen Center? New to the Zen Center, but not new to the Sangha. Welcome, dear friend. Welcome to everybody. My name is Patrice. I'm a longtime student here. And I always start my any talks that I give by expressing my gratitude for this beautiful path of practice and for my teachers. And I'd like to mention a couple of them tonight. My first teacher, Catherine Thanis, our late abbot. This was her seat for many, many years. And a good friend of mine that I had, I had the good fortune, the blessing to see again this summer, Brother David Steindl-Rast, who just turned 90. He is a Benedictine monk, and also was a very early practitioner with Suzuki Roshi, the very first practice periods of Tassajara. So these two dear friends have everything to do with me being here and seeing everybody tonight. So I'd like to talk tonight about taking refuge in the three treasures, or we call the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And Shohaku Okamura has said that without these three, there is no Buddhism. They're foundational to our practice. We recite these refuges in morning and evening services in many different ceremonies. We often say, I take refuge in Buddha as the perfect teacher. I take refuge in Dharma as the perfect teaching. I take refuge in Sangha as the perfect life. And those of us who have sewn Buddha's robe, I know there's many of us here with, if those of you who haven't can see how many little stitches there are in these robes, and especially the longer cases that the priests and teachers wear. And with every stitch, that mantra is recited, I take refuge in Buddha, Namukye Butsu. So these are they're important recitations, but I think they're more than just chants. Suzuki Roshi, I found a Dharma talk of his online that he gave in June 1967 Sesshin. And it must have been at Tassajara, and that must have been a very early Sesshin. And in that Dharma talk, he exhorted his students to approach taking refuge as a practice. He said, you should take refuge in the triple treasure with real effort, not false effort, emphasizing the importance of a genuine sort of practice of taking refuge, not just reciting the words. So I'd like to talk about taking refuge as a practice activity. So, of course, it's a word that we encounter commonly. We hear this word almost every day now, because every day, if you listen to the news, we hear the word refugee. And we know that refugees are people, or beings also, with the fires that we have now, seeking shelter, seeking protection. In fact, Webster says shelter or protection from danger, trouble, anything to which one has recourse for aid, relief, or escape is a refuge. And some synonyms are safety and sanctuary, protection. And just to consider for a moment all the people and animals fleeing conflict and fire and war at the present moment, the world is alive with beings seeking refuge, and we are as well in our own hearts. Sometimes, I know when I hear the word, I think of it as a place apart from wherever the conflict is. Some sort of a haven or some sort of a sanctuary, like a wildlife refuge. But in fact, in taking refuge in our practice, we're not going anywhere. We're moving inside. We're moving into and toward whatever conflict is present or arising, into the heart of that conflict and into the contradiction and confusion that's inherent in spiritual or emotional danger. So finding a place of balance or equanimity. I was in Tassajara for about 3.5 weeks this summer, just before overlapped a little bit with the fire settling in, and safety was on very much on everyone's mind. And an old friend of mine gave a Dharma talk, and at the end of the talk he quoted the Genjo koan: to study the Buddha ways, to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And then he read a quote from Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, about the Genjo koan. And Suzuki Roshi said, when we forget the self, we become one with the activity of big existence. Then there is no problem whatsoever. My friend ended his talk like that. And I was very dissatisfied with that formula. I was almost sort of stunned because I pretty much was sure, and maybe still am sure, that no matter what, there are a lot of problems whatsoever. And getting worse and worse problems whatsoever. And trouble in our own hearts, in our families, our relationships, in our workplaces, in our communities, across the United States, internationally, problems of deep inequity, oppression, degradation, destruction of our entire living planet. So I just couldn't imagine a state of mind or a state of the world in which there's no problem whatsoever. And you could almost hear Suzuki Roshi saying after that, so thank you very much, you know, really bowing. So I talked to my friend about it. I said, how is it possible? We become one with the mind of big existence, whatever that is. Sounds like an ultimate refuge, then there's no problem whatsoever. But I think that Suzuki Roshi was inviting us to look more deeply into the nature of self as a way to take refuge, and really maybe saying that beginning with ourselves, becoming united with the activity of, he's the phrase, big existence. We could say ultimate existence, ultimate reality, all that is, becoming one. Later on, he goes to say the truth. This is the self that takes refuge. Not the nature of the self that takes refuge is that's ordinary self, but devoted to the path of awakening. So we're not avoiding conflicts or problems, but we're not becoming embroiled or polarized in them either, which seems to me my problem of late. Pick anything you want to out of the news, and I can tell you what my polarized extreme position is on it, just for any divide that you'd like to mention. And then I can also tell you about that, you know, it's completely obvious that a polarized or divided or extreme positions will never end suffering. They sort of just fuel an ongoing engine of suffering. But how can the self become a little more flexible, a little bit more transparent in that process? And Suzuki Roshi, again in this sesshin, he's talking about this self that becomes one with the activity of big existence, and in that process taking refuge. He says, this so-called I is just a swinging door. It's a door which moves with inhaling and exhaling. When we inhale, the air we take in comes into our inner world. When we exhale, the air we exhale goes to the outer world. The inner world is limitless. The outer world is limitless. So this I that is expanding, that is becoming awakened, is sort of a watcher, sort of a witness at this subtle threshold between inner and outer. Very subtle threshold. In fact, we say in Zen there is no inside and no outside. Nonetheless, it seems sort of natural to sort of harden the self around a position, and therefore decrease the likelihood that in any sort of conflict or distress that refuge will be available. When I think of the self in refuge, I think also of the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin in her royal ease position. Kuan Yin is the Bodhisattva of compassion, and she has a lot of different positions. Sometimes she's sitting on a lotus for her throne or riding on a fish. When I was in China, we saw her in all these different positions. But the one that I'm the fondest of and that speaks to me about refuge is called the royal ease. And I'm sort of, maybe, Kathy, can you demonstrate the royal ease position? Do you know what it is?
Remind me.
Yeah, and that's going to do it. She's sort of like, I can almost do it too with one leg down, but it's sort of like, on the one hand, completely relaxed.
Yeah.
On the other hand, completely ready to move into action of whatever is required, whatever skillful means is required at the moment. It's completely relaxed. There's a Reb likes to exhort the teaching. Liz, I may have even seen this on the back of your Rakasu or somebody's Rakasu. I've seen it. That he writes, meeting whatever arises with complete relaxation. So I think what we're doing in taking refuge is the first thing we say is before all beings. We're not really running away. We're in the midst of everything and everybody, and we're willing to meet whatever arises. When we're doing the full moon ceremony tomorrow night, and at Tassajara now, they say these full moon refuges with every morning service. They say, I take refuge in Buddha before all beings, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening true mind. We'll say that tomorrow. The refuges are sort of a centerpiece of the full moon ceremony where we renew our vows. So this first of the three treasures, taking refuge in Buddha, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening true mind. Suzuki Roshi had to say in this same Sesshin talk, to take refuge in Buddha means to become one with Buddha, or to find our true nature. To find our true nature, which is not different from Buddha's nature. I think on the surface it's sort of tempting. I know it is for me at times to imagine, well, you know, who can I run to for help? You know, Buddha, Jesus, you know, who's there? Help me, you know? Where's my celestial parent? But Catherine would always say, we don't say we have faith in Buddha. We say we have the faith of Buddha. And that's also in this teaching that Suzuki Roshi is giving. We're awakening our true mind, which is not different from the mind of Buddha, or Thich Nhat Hanh says, or the mind of Christ, or the mind of Muhammad. And it's the mind of enlightenment. But it does require something beyond just a cry for help. Suzuki Roshi says, pure faith includes our mental, physical, and verbal effort. He's very careful to include speech there. Our mental, physical, and verbal effort. So pure faith means not just faith in something, but real action. Reality, realized action. It's necessary to have real practice and real effort. You should take refuge in the triple treasure with real effort, not false effort. So when I was reflecting on this, becoming, you know, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening true mind, I was thinking of some of the qualities of true mind, or awakened mind, or enlightened mind. We like to say that awakened mind is boundless. It's unlimited by any particular perspective or collection of perspectives that we might hold. And that it's also harmless. When we follow this bodhisattva path, we're devoting ourselves to a path of harmlessness, to be non-defensive and non-reactive. Again, this relaxation, watching and listening, ready to respond from compassion, from wisdom and compassion. And also, importantly, in these times of conflict, awakened mind is non-dualistic. It's Thich Nhat Hanh's concept of interbeing. When I was at Tassajara, I reread Thich Nhat Hanh's book on anger. It's just called Anger. And it's a great book, especially if you have any work that you're doing around anger. I highly recommend it. But he says about this, you know, this sort of taking refuge, especially in the midst of a time of anger. He says, deep down, you must know that you are capable of being peace. Develop the conviction that the energy of Buddha or Christ is in you. You have enough peace, you have enough compassion, you have enough understanding in the depth of your consciousness. The only thing you need to do is to call upon it for help. So in this sense, we're taking refuge in our deepest, truest, boundless, most peaceful nature. We have to touch peace, become peace in ourselves, certainly before we can extend it to anybody else. So I'll just give you a little example of how I practice with this in my working life. And I'm sure you all have your own examples. Maybe we can talk about those in a little while. In my day job, so to speak, I'm a counseling psychologist at the university, and for many decades now have been meeting with a lot of students who are in distress. And they set up appointments for mental health counseling, and they come in, and oftentimes there's been a prolonged period of tremendous distress, maybe years, maybe trauma, upheaval, abuse, loss, sometimes acute and sudden, or sometimes sort of an accumulation of life's burdens. But you can pretty much count on every single situation, counseling is the last resort. It's usually not the first, you know, like, I think I'll go try some counseling. No. It's like it's been recommended for years, it's been considered for years, and when the person is finally at their wit's end and tried everything else, they might try counseling. So the person who shows up is desperate. And they want relief immediately. And they're looking at counseling, and maybe even at me, as some sort of an aid, a recourse, maybe even a potential refuge. Sometimes they have, like many of us do, and have had their own behaviors might be deepening their suffering or increasing their suffering. They might not be ready to look at those behaviors yet. Might involve the use of a substance or a toxic relationship, say, that's making panic worse, but they're just really focused on, you know, I need to make this panic go away. So there's a tremendous pressure and desperation of a soul in need, sort of washing up in this direction. From this direction are all the constraints of the system that I work in, which means, like, I have very little time to spend with any one person. I really don't have the kind of time that it takes to establish a lot of trust and a deep dialogue that comes with that. I am constantly getting phone calls and emails about all the other people that are waiting to get in. So I had to be careful in this situation, and I pretty much have to do it every time, not to react out of the pressure of the situation. I have to establish some sort of an inner peaceful spot before I can respond in any way. And if I'm not careful, I find myself seeking my own refuge in the situation. I have to get out of this situational pressure somehow. My own frustration or anxiety is arising. It's not so different from many of the pressures we experience in life, conflicting pressures. But Thich Nhat Hanh says, in this sort of situation, the thing to remember above all else is what it takes to cook potatoes. And I think he's got a good point, because to cook potatoes, what you have to do is put some potatoes in water, you have to put a lid on, and you have to turn up the heat. And you have to give it some time for that heat to act. So he means you have to right away engage mindful breathing. Mindful walking, if you can, or mindful breathing. Because the moment you establish mindfulness in a situation like this, he says, you're safe. You have to stay present to everything that arises, the frustration, the anxiety, to find a center balance point and to not lash out one way or the other to try to get out of this high pressure, high conflict situation. You have to immerse body and mind. I take refuge in awakened mind, immersing body and mind deeply in the way. What does that mean? It means bringing mind and body together here. The body isn't really going elsewhere, but the mind goes elsewhere. Bringing the mind and body together here, deeply in the way, immersing mind and body deeply in the way. Well, where's the way? Well, according to Dogen, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs. Actualizing the fundamental point. Here is the place. Here the way unfolds. So that's our refuge, our true nature. Awake and present, using mindful breathing, mindful awareness of what's circulating in the mind to bring body and mind together here. And to touch peace in that way gives a remarkable opportunity for compassion to arise. I take refuge in Buddha. The second treasure, I take refuge in Dharma, the extended version, I take refuge in Dharma before all beings. Entering deeply the merciful ocean of Buddha's way. And Suzuki Roshi said, Dharma is the teaching of Buddha. We sometimes refer to Dharma as a teaching, but it's also truth itself. And he uses a capital T for truth. We should obtain the truth. We should become one with the truth. That is taking refuge in Buddha or truth. When we become one, there's no communion or interrelationship. It's just one. That is taking refuge in the true sense. So, what is truth? What is truth with a capital T? What is this truth that we seek to become one with? I think for me this has been a good koan. We call it a koan or a sort of an open question, but a question that encourages us to open to new possibilities rather than obtain some sort of a quick answer to. Because truth is always bigger than what we could imagine or think that it is. Any explanation or any perspective or any perception or any understanding of a situation, it's only perhaps a glimpse of a boundless truth, a bigger truth. So what is truth? And I've been practicing this, taking refuge in the truth, in sort of a family conflict that I've had for a long time. I'll just tell you about it by way to give you a little example. But I've been practicing this way with my three sisters for the past year. My three sisters we're fairly close in age. All three of us are within 10 years. The three of them live in Northeast Ohio, which is where I grew up. And we've had many competing truths in our relationships. There have been many long-term divisions among us. We grew up surrounded by very strict conventional standards for gender, for sexual orientation, for family roles. We were held to these standards very strictly, very strictly. And there were certain, you know, sort of approved identities that were often very harshly enforced by community or family or religion. There was sort of a tyranny of right and wrong. And it wasn't really in the plan, in the family handbook, to, you know, for somebody like me to emerge, somebody who was queer, radical, feminist, Buddhist, from the Green Party. You know, there wasn't really a template for that. So there's been a lot of pressure over the years to sort of fit in certain ways. On all sides. On my side too, a lot of implicit and explicit judgments and rejections over the years. And I think in the past year, and I have to say it's been the younger generation who's really helped us do this more, my vast sea of 28 nieces and nephews, who are a little bit more flexible, in their family expectations and in their inclusivity. So what I'm doing with my sisters, and I think what they're sort of doing with me now, is who are you beyond my perceptions of who you are? And I think that's an effort to take refuge in what is true without really knowing what the truth is. But it's a way to try and bridge a divide between people. It requires a lot of humility. Humility to, I have to sort of joke with myself, and when I get sort of too out there, I just sort of repeat my little mantra to myself. I just say, my way is the best way. My way is the best way. And I say that until I start laughing at myself, because I really do believe that my way is the best. I just can't get out of it. But if I keep saying it enough, I just, becomes like a little joke. It takes a lot of honesty to, I think, be humble, and a lot of humility to be honest. It takes risk as well. And really, to really believe, to understand that my perspective, all of our perspectives, are limited by the causes and conditions of this one life. Everything is occurring within this one mind. All the reality that I can perceive is from this one mind, which is at the same time ordinary and at the same time awake. And those two aren't different. The truth is not separate from things as it is. That can embrace everything, all of our contradictions, all of our arguments, all of our opposites, our opposing points of view. It's a refuge. It is an ocean of mercy. It's a deep ocean of mercy to take a risk. And we're sort of all doing this now in our little interactions, and have that risk met with a curiosity that kind of is going back to this truth seeking. It's this type of taking refuge toward what's true. We had a Rinpoche visit us at Tassajara this summer, and he gave a little talk, and he ended his talk by reciting the refuges in Pali three times at each end. And he said that taking refuge acts on what he called the self-cherishing I. So it's not this self-cherishing I that, it's not so much a truth seeker. It's more a validation seeker, I think. Wants to sort of be reinforced. But there's no, that's the way to polarization. I mean, we see it. It's easy to blame. It's easy to point out enemies, to oppose. I mean, we see it. It's happening. It happens on the smallest interactions. It happens on the biggest world stage. There's no end to the suffering of opposite sides. Our ordinary mind, our perceptions, our judgments, our feelings, they're important. They inform us. They give us information. But if we're too attached, too rigidly to them, they can form walls of the mind. I love this phrase from Red Pine's translation of the Heart Sutra, Walls of the Mind. He said, Bodhisattvas take refuge in Prajna Paramita. We could say the perfection of wisdom. Wisdom, compassion, awakened nature, the truth. Bodhisattvas take refuge in Prajna Paramita and live without walls of the mind. Without walls of the mind, there is no fear. So, and maybe it's both ways. Maybe it's the fear that leads us to create and retreat behind these walls, but maybe the walls create more fear. And I mean, imagine for a moment a mind without walls of fear. Imagine for a moment that type of fearlessness spreading in communities and in the world. So with my sisters, I take refuge in this bigger, boundless truth that embraces and supports all of us, the refuge of not knowing. I'll give them a little shout out in case they listen to this talk. What's up, sissies? Lori, Susan, and Janelle. We call her the Jaybird. I take refuge in Sangha, the third treasure, before all beings, I take refuge in Sangha before all beings, bringing harmony to everyone, free from hindrance. And Suzuki Roshi says, our common understanding, Sangha, the community of practitioners, the community of people who join in practice with harmony and unity, that's taking refuge in Sangha. But he says, again in this 1967 Sesshin talk, Sangha is also the state of harmony and unity. And I like to reflect and sort of nourish myself with images of harmony and unity, free from hindrance, as exemplified by nature. This is a beautiful little book, Cultivating the Empty Field, by Zen Master Hong Shur. He has in his little preface this beautiful image of harmony and unity free from hindrance. I'll just read it for you. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountain appears. The moon sets and the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. So this is an image of no hindrance. Many different systems and cycles and nature's operating free from hindrance, bringing harmony to everyone. It's a sort of, a portrait of interbeing. Bringing harmony to everyone. That means everyone. It means, we don't really get to pick and choose who we're bringing harmony to, unfortunately. Because some people are easier to relate to harmoniously than others in my experience. But that's because I already have a wall of the mind against those people. Bringing harmony to everyone. We're not taking sides. We're not assigning blame. We're not making someone into an enemy. I had an interesting experience of this harmony recently. I was recently back from Tassajara earlier this month. And those of you who have spent time there, even probably for a weekend, will understand what I mean when I say I came back spacey but grounded. So I was sort of, not quite detail-oriented enough in negotiating the everyday tasks of routine life, which are, normally we do very automatically, such as driving, in the example I'm going to give you, but also very just emotionally sort of grounded with sort of a higher threshold for irritation or, a little bit more generous toward others. After about 3.5 weeks practice there, just following the schedule, which anybody can do in the summer, by the way. It's a great practice. So I was in my car and driving extremely slowly in a parking garage, which was right away sort of mind-boggling to me, because in this parking garage there was one part of it that was two-way and one part of it that was one-way. And I wasn't quite figuring this out, and I sort of a little bit too late realized I was starting to go into the one-way part. But I realized it pretty quickly because of the size of it, and I just pulled over, and there was somebody behind me who was following me and thinking I knew what I was doing, probably into the one-way, and pulled over. So we're both sort of pulled over trying to get out of the way of the car that's coming the right way in the one-way. And so this car comes up, and me and the car behind me are completely stopped. I have my windows down all the way. Here comes the car toward me, the window is down, and it's a very narrow space, like probably from here to this ton, here comes this car, or even closer. And there's a white guy in the car, and he's shouting already. He's got no hands on the steering wheel, he's got his hands on his head, and he's sort of shouting, "It's one way!" He really wants us to, "It's one way!" It's one way, sort of half shouting, half yelling at probably the both of us. And I was just fascinated by this display. I was sort of in this state where maybe, if it was my normal everyday state, I'd be very quick to maybe sense a threat or become irritated, to sort of interpret it as some sort of perhaps a casual aggression. And normally I probably would have felt a little threatened, for sure, irritated. And, you know, here he is coming right by my window. And normally I probably would have just, you know, given a quick, sincere but quick apology. But, you know, because I was in this different state, this wasn't really consciously happening, but I sort of received an impression of him as sort of more anguished and frustrated than hostile. You know, he's practically tearing his hair out, the poor guy. This was like a total last straw experience for him. How could these people not see that it was the one way? And what was the matter with us? And as he came by, sort of chanting and screaming and yelling, he was very close to me, so I didn't have to speak very loudly. I just said, I got you, man. I said, I got you. I got you. Just like that. And he just dropped the whole thing. And we both were just sitting there like in this silence. And then he just kind of kept going on. He didn't say anything to the car behind me. But it was sort of just like this organic response that, I mean, I'm not sure what I communicated by that, but what I felt was, you know, I hear you. I'm here. I'm listening to you. I hear you. I get it. I understand. I'm sorry. It's okay. You know, I'm not sure what was going on there, but it was just so unusual. But it was this, it was just like this harmonious, and we were cooperating in that experience, you know, and just, you know, looking at the word, we were like cooperating, like I was doing my thing, he was doing, we didn't set out to have some sort of harmony or cooperation, but we were cooperating without hindering each other. It was just a beautiful little example that in another context could have turned into all-out warfare. And I've had those experiences with rage on the road, with others and with, you know, my own self. So it just was sort of accidentally beautiful. Anyway, again, able to meet the situation with complete relaxation. Sekitokisa in the Song of the Graff Roof Hermitage has another beautiful little quote about relaxation where he says, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Isn't that beautiful? And it also says, you know, again, because we're interbeing, it's a model for how to relate to and perceive others. You know, just let it go. Whatever you have against this person, hundreds of years, take, you know, assume it's been developing for hundreds of years. In that moment, let it go. Relax completely. Take a breath. Open your hands. Hold yourself and the other person blameless. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you won't regard anyone as an enemy when you have penetrated the reality of interbeing. You won't regard anyone as an enemy when you have penetrated completely the reality of interbeing. Does our world need that teaching? Do our hearts need that teaching? I think for me, this really is the heart of taking refuge, is embracing this radical interbeing. It's not really an individual act. It's taking refuge is with and for all of us and all beings, and trusting ourselves, taking refuge in the Buddha, we become the practice of awakening here. We become the practice of awakened mind here. Here the way unfolds. Taking refuge in Dharma, we become one with the boundless nature of truth and the humility and honesty to not know, especially in uncomfortable moments of conflict or anger or distress, instead of avoiding, retreating, taking sides, constructing or retreating behind a wall of the mind, let go of hundreds of years. Open your hands and walk innocently. Taking refuge in Sangha, we express effort and activity that reflects the interbeing of all that is. And then when we practice taking refuge in these ways, we're safe. We, like Dogen said, we're like a dragon gaining the water. We're like a tiger entering the forest. That's the depth of our refuge. So, I think that's about all that. I might have gone a little fast because it's a little, I know we're giving a little shorter Dharma talks nowadays, but we do have time if anybody wants to have any discussion or share any examples from your own life or ask any questions. That's about all I had. Patrick. Reverend Patrick.
Someone once pointed out to me that every time we walk down Pacific Garden Mall, we're really kind of dropping body and mind and agreeing, you know, not to just run headlong into each other, that or driving down the freeway, we agree to put some of our body and mind aside, just so that we can all, as you said, cooperate harmoniously. And so I mean, that made me think that it's that this taking refuge in, say, Sangha isn't a monumental task that's far away from us that we have to achieve, which is something that we do all the time, that we agree to cooperate on some level. It's like walking on a crowded street, or it's like merging onto the freeway.
That's like the sort of cooperation. It's something that we already have many agreements for how we do, and it just could be a natural extension to do that, maybe a little bit more of a challenge to do it with the greater good in mind, with the benefit of others in mind. A lot of these, I was listening to, and a lot of these I'm thinking, yeah, I do that because I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to crash into somebody or have a car accident. Or a lot of it, I think, it can come from self-protection, but it can also come from natural and already established ways that we operate together without hindrance. There's a lot of activity, I think, in workplaces that goes on like that too, as well, that we're operating for a greater goal. So it is part of our ordinary life, our ordinary mind. Yeah, did you have another comment? Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, Liz?
Thank you so much. And struck by how you're just the story from the parking garage is really fun and also really familiar, and you're linking it to practicing at Tassajara and how beautiful and mysterious that we don't really know what we're relinquishing to, but to just follow the schedule, we do exert some faith that it's okay to drop right and wrong and just go to Zendo, But then it shows up in our being that we're open to more possibility. Yeah,
and we don't even have to know, Like, I didn't really have a plan to do anything in that parking garage, and I didn't even know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I just sort of...
The meaning is not in the words.
Right. It's just sort of like, find your place. I just found my place. Mm-hmm. I just found my place in that entire situation in what felt like a natural way, and that's what happened. It was pretty funny.
In the library this afternoon studying, and I noticed a fellow the next table over, and he had a jar of peanut butter and a bag of bread, and he had his cell phone plugged in. He was making a call, and he was a friendly guy. I was just charging your cell phone. He's like, yeah, I had to check if I still have a job. I was like, oh, do you? And he's like, yeah, I do. Just 3 days a week and a Jack in the Box. It's not the greatest, but I still have a job. He was so friendly, and I was like, do you have a place to live? He's like, no. But just, yeah, it just felt so much warmth for him, and he was so open, and we just had a really nice exchange. But I left there just really thinking about him, and, you know, where is he going to stay tonight?
The cloud in the mountains, you know, very different, but no hindrance. Diane.
I'm so glad I'm here.
Yeah.
When I drive, I practice in Monterey, I live in Monterey. When I come to Santa Cruz, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm driving towards light. Because it is such a more active, vital, diverse community than I live in. And a little bit today, I was hiding from my own sangha, you know, to find something I feel I need that isn't there. And you kind of took care of that, but we worked together. And after I got over the trauma of working there, and facing every day that intensity, my heart was so free. Mm. You know, I really was able to enter my own practice and my own life, knowing that I could face almost anything from what I had to face daily there. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just such a joy to see you.
Good to see you too.
And to hear your words.
Yeah, Diane and I worked together for many, many years in the old days at the counseling center, and in what I consider still to this day one of the absolute hardest positions in the university. That Diane did a sort of the front desk position of, you know, meeting students for the first time who come in, meeting everything with an open heart. So good to see you. Did you have a comment? No? Okay, just waving. Yes, Lenore.
When I started my working life post-child rearing, I started out as an administrative assistant, destined to become a tech writer. So an administrative assistant has to deal with people in all sorts of other departments to get the supplies we need, to get this and that and the other, get the electrician up here and the tech support call. And at some point I spotted the opportunity for game that I wanted to try. And that was to look for people that I had a hard time getting a hard time dealing with. It was always seemed like an adversarial relationship when I went to them. But we were working for the same company and the same thought. And I thought, I'll see if I can turn that around. And so what it ended up doing was me going and listening, you know, saying something like, I don't know how you do your job. And then they'll go on and on and on. Boy, you really are up against it. And then I was like, now, what can I do for you? And it happened every time. The product manager that spent 45 minutes in a meeting telling us why his programmers did not have time to help us tech writers understand what the program was about, you know, so that we could write the online help and the manuals. And after 45 minutes, it was again, wow, you really are up against it. And then he said, now, what can I do for you? The last 15 minutes of the meeting, he started that one. Just basically, essentially, the stuff we were asking for. And it's still a pleasure to me, too. If I run on, I don't interact with people that much in retirement. But, you know, I want to keep that in mind. And I'm not sure what that has to do with taking refuge in it. It just happened. It has something to do with wanting to no dualism with this relationship, wanting us to be one.
Yeah, you're not making yourself separate. There's no wall there.
There's no wall.
Between you and the other person, and there's no preconception.
The wall is to listen to this person.
Yeah. Do you sit like Kuan Yin when you do it?
They want somebody to hear them.
That's right. That's right. In fact, that's one of the most profound and simple ways of extending refuge for others is to listen deeply. And I don't think we can do that unless we're really present right here, dropping our own preoccupations and our own preconceptions.
There is something, I'm assuming this is a good person, assuming this person, at heart.
Yeah.
Dropping any
not making enemies.
Dropping any assumptions ask them really where they're coming from.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Reverend Toldy.
Well, your story is just very to the point, I think, for the teaching, and thank you for that. I'm thinking with your sisters. One of the things you said, I don't remember exactly the words, but not presuming that you know each other. Mm-hmm. Like, we're seeing beyond your stories that you've told about each other all these years of, I know, she's the this one and you're the that one.
Right.
And how we do that so often with our siblings and mm-hmm. our top coworkers and our everybody.
Yeah.
And so that I'm finding to be a really inspiring example of, who are you actually?
Yeah.
And I think in a way, you and the fellow in the parking garage were doing that, because mm-hmm. you could have looked at him in one way, and he could have, he was thinking, who's that idiot?
Yeah.
And you could have thought, who's that, overly reacting, out of control person?
Mm-hmm.
And if the idiot and the out of control reacting person, if they're going to solidify their positions, that's an explosion.
That's a literal explosion.
You know what I mean?
And that's a world stage explosion.
Yeah.
We can see that happening right now.
And and it's really cool to me that he too was somehow in the presence of just the present moment, something just unexpected and real. Now, people don't always do that, but he did. Something in him, he dropped his angry guy thing, and there was silence.
All of a sudden, it was just the moon and the clouds parted, and there was the mountain. I mean, neither one of us really made it happen.
Yeah.
We just met each other in that. In that moment, and I think that's also, this practice with my sisters, it's like we do a lot of texting since they're in Northeast Ohio, and I took my youngest sister, we were texting and sort of dropped in her conversation what I, to me, was a sort of a casual racist stereotype, and I spoke to it in as loving in a way as I could, and as direct in a way. Silence, no more time. waiting. I'm like, okay, am I exiled? What's going to happen now? Is nobody's going to respond to me for 24 hours? But then she texted back. She said, thank you. She said, I need that kind of help. And I was like, wow, you got to be kidding me. Who is this person? Wow. Yeah.
We all do. I mean, we all have blind spots.
That's what I
when we can be intimate enough to support each other with our blind spots, that's really
powerful. Yeah, that gave me the opportunity to say I work on myself every day, every opportunity. This is not again, to not make these walls or assign blame or make somebody a bad person. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, this whole family thing. What else? Any other, anything else anybody would like to share? Well, maybe it's time for some tea then. And thank you all so very much. This has been a pleasure to speak with you tonight. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.